I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates explained to a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee that she told White House counsel Donald McGahn that National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had lied about his conversations with the Russian ambassador. This was on January 26, just a few days after Donald Trump became president.
The first thing we did was to explain to Mr. McGahn that the underlying conduct that General Flynn had engaged in was problematic in and of itself. Secondly, we told him we felt like the vice president and others were entitled to know that the information that they were conveying to the American people wasn't true. We told him the third reason was is because we were concerned that the American people had been misled about the underlying conduct and what General Flynn had done. And additionally, that we weren't the only ones that knew all of this, that the Russians also knew about what General Flynn had done, and the Russians also knew that General Flynn had misled the vice president and others, because in the media accounts, it was clear from the vice president and others that they were repeating what General Flynn had told them, and that this was a problem, because not only did we believe that the Russians knew this, but that they likely had proof of this information. And that created a compromise situation, a situation where the National Security Advisor essentially could be blackmailed by the Russians.
Sally Yates was fired a few days later for refusing to uphold the president's travel ban. Flynn kept his job until mid-February and even sat in on highly classified meetings, including a phone call between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. We asked Andy Wright to join us. He's founding editor of Just Security, a professor at Savannah Law School. He also served as staff director and counsel to the National Security Subcommittee on Oversight and Government Reform. He also served as Assistant Counsel to Vice President Al Gore. And Andy Wright, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
What did you learn yesterday that you didn't know?
Well, the first thing we got was a whole lot of specifics about the TikTok that happened in terms of Yates' notification, along with a senior official from the National Security Division of the Department of Justice, to White House Counsel Don McGahn and one of his associates. We found out that there were two substantive meetings and one substantive phone call. As she just laid out in the clip that you played, there were, you know, a number of reasons that they were quite concerned, both in terms of General Flynn's conduct itself as problematic and perhaps illegal, but also the fact that senior White House officials, including the Vice President of the United States, had been misled to the point that they were spreading falsehoods to the American people. The independent concern about the American people's right to candor, which I'll just remind folks that while we don't police politicians' false statements by means of impeachment, that was among the articles of impeachment of President Nixon when there were material lies related to ongoing investigations. And then finally, and in some ways most chilling, the fact that Russians, our adversary, had the same information that was being withheld from the American people about the true nature of General Flynn's conduct, which led him to be potentially compromised. And Sally Yates couldn't have said much more categorically that he had been compromised by the Russians at that point. And so the fifth point was really, you know, what moves it away from Flynn's problems to all of our problems, which is that the White House allowed him to stay on board for another 18 days after they had been put on quite stark notice that he posed a threat to our national security.
Well, let me pick up on several things. It's in that clip, but she said this several times yesterday about Flynn's underlying conduct was problematic. Now, she was on the record, she was under oath, but dealing obviously with classified information from time to time. How do you interpret that? Underlying conduct.
Yeah, well, so there are several things that could reference. The first, and what sort of started this controversy, is if there were communications intercepted under our normal intelligence collection procedures of a foreign ambassador of an adversary country, like the Russian ambassador, that would have picked up conversations he was having with General Flynn that were discussing sanctions, that could be problematic under the Logan Act. It also might relate to some of the issues related to emoluments that General Flynn had taken by accepting payments from Russian Times and Foreign Agent Registration Act. The second issue is that she indicated that he had been interviewed by the FBI on January 24th. And part of that also could be that, and I certainly came away with the impression that she was suggesting that he was not truthful with the FBI during that January 24th interview. If that's the case, then he's got an additional problem under 18 U.S.C. Section 1001, which is a felony for giving false statements to federal officials within their subject matter jurisdiction.
So, I mean, is he in deeper trouble as of yesterday and Sally Yates' testimony? And I also should add that we also heard from James Clapper, former director of National Intelligence. Is it a more dire day for Michael Flynn today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it confirmed facts from a source, you know, a primary source that had been reported through secondary and anonymous sources previously about how much legal jeopardy he may be in. And in addition, it's created a different sort of political atmosphere. I mean, every time these facts tumble out into the space, it's hard to, you know, our prosecutors try to shield themselves when they're making their decisions from political influences, but it's certainly the political climate is worsening when you've got multiple congressional committees investigating. If I could just make one comment about Director Clapper's testimony, he also gave some pretty interesting testimony. He confirmed that multiple European allies at one point in an exchange with Senator Feinstein, that multiple European allies had given information provided information related to Russian contacts with Trump associates and Trump campaign associates. And that was, I thought, a pretty important fact that was sort of buried in the middle of all the testimony. And he also indicated that the White House had asked him to keep certain information confidential on grounds of executive privilege. And I think that's something that will be interesting to find out if we find out more about what their grounds were and what types of information was he was asked to shield, because apparently he honored that request.
These are questions you probably cannot answer, but they're questions I think that hang over this. One is, why did the White House counsel McGahn basically say, according to Sally Yates, what's the big deal if one member of the executive branch lies to another? I'm not sure how to understand that. But also, Flynn himself, a long career in the military, national security, he had to have known that if he was having, and he was having, conversations with the Russian ambassador, that people would be listening in and know what they were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I find General Flynn's conduct inexplicable. You know, hopefully at some point we'll get a chance to hear from him. I know that his counsel had floated the idea of immunity, although I think that's a non-starter. But I hope we get a chance as American people to hear what was motivating him and what he was thinking, because it is so shocking. In some ways, though, Don McGahn is a little bit more curious, because he's obviously not implicated in the underlying problematic or illegal conduct. And so, as you know, my old mentor Bob Bennett used to say, who's a great lawyer, he used to say, you know, you may have flunked the facts, but we're not going to let you flunk the investigation when our clients would come in the door. And McGahn is the one who's in the position as the president's senior lawyer, who's got to protect him and the office of the presidency from further damage. And the idea that he would sort of wave off the national security advisor to the president sitting at the epicenter of the Situation Room and all of our national security decisions, who's, you know, the acting attorney general and a career professional from the National Security Division, have suggested he's compromised by a foreign adversary. That judgment really needs to be called into question, and it just raises all sorts of questions about what happened with the information once it got to McGahn inside the White House. Who did he talk to? What did he tell the president? What did he tell the vice president? And what was the choice that was made not to remove General Flynn from his position, or from sensitive, at least wall him off from sensitive information during those 18 days, even after, as Sally Yates testified yesterday, that on the 27th of January, in response to one of Don McGahn's questions, they had informed them that removing General Flynn or walling him off would not compromise ongoing FBI activity. They weren't trying to sting him at that point, because they'd already interviewed him. So they'd gotten the green light to remove him, and they decided to sit on their hands until the Washington Post reported it 18 days later.
Does Yates' testimony yesterday raise questions about what both Sean Spicer and Reince Priebus said about these meetings, or this meeting, was that Yates was basically just giving them a heads up? Clearly, from her testimony yesterday, she was saying, you have a problem on your hand.
Yeah, I mean, that spin is not holding up to scrutiny. scrutiny. And so clearly, anyone who both, I mean, Sean Spicer's got it coming and going because both of them and the White House Chief of Staff, they repeated the comments that Flynn had said. So they were, A, told by Flynn false information that they related to the American people thereafter. And then on the investigative stage, they've sort of spun this meeting with Yates, which sounds to me like a very serious meeting. When the acting attorney general says, I've got something so hot to handle, I need to come tell you in person, and I'm going to bring along one staffer who's the senior most career person from the National Security Division so I can come talk to you in your SCIF, because the White House Counsel's Office is a SCIF that can where you can freely discuss classified material. That is a clear signal that this isn't just a hey, heads up kind of topic.
Do we know what President Trump knew about Flynn? I mean, we know that eventually he fired him. I mean, praised him and fired him. But at one point, do we know when the president knew about what Sally Yates had told McGahn?
Well, I have seen reporting to the effect that Don McGahn immediately told the president, but we have not heard a primary source that I've seen on that topic. And it would certainly be the kind of thing that would go to the heart of what I would want to know if I were a congressional investigator who was either the Intelligence Committees or in Lindsey Graham's Senate Judiciary Subcommittee. I would want to know the answer to that question, because it goes to the judgment that they made about whether to keep Flynn. And the other thing I'll just say is, even after all this information has come out, President Trump, as recently as yesterday, is standing by him and reportedly was angry that there were other people on his White House staff giving blind quotes criticizing General Flynn's judgment and his conduct. And it's hard for me to fathom how the President of the United States would allow his National Security Advisor to be lying to the Vice President of the United States and still sticking up for him all this time later.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, and I've heard others ask this question again: if the Washington Post hadn't written that story and it was based on leaks, would Michael Flynn still be the National Security Advisor?
We have no indication that there was any plan by the White House to remove him absent outside pressure from journalism or other leakers. And so that is distressing to me. Maybe they can come forward with some that they were getting ready. They had an action plan, but we haven't seen anything to suggest that they would remove him absent that Washington Post story.
Was that a good hearing yesterday from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite newsy. I actually thought there was more information that they were able to discuss than I thought, because given the nexus to classified material, I thought there would be a lot more jousting about what you can and can't say. But I thought we got a lot of insight into how these communications went down and how people reacted to information once it was given. So I thought it was quite a newsworthy hearing.
Well, Andy Wright, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And he's founding editor of Just Security. He's also a professor at Savannah Law School. Hala Alyan waiting in the wings. She's got a new novel, It's her debut novel. It's called Salt Houses, about issues of identity and dislocation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've all heard many heart-wrenching stories about migrants and refugees fleeing the Syrian civil war, the gangs of Central America, Boko Haram in Nigeria. Conflict and violence around the world has forced millions of people out of their homes and communities, left in many ways to fend for themselves. Our guest Hala Alyan's novel, Salt Houses, is about the displacement of a well-to-do Palestinian family, the Yaqubs, back in 1960s, and its impact on four generations who end up living on three different continents, including the United States. Alyan explores the impact of being uprooted on identity, on faith, belonging, storytelling, and something the writer calls emotional code switching. She's Palestinian-American, was born born in the U.S., spent years going back and forth between this country and cities in the Middle East. She's a poet, psychologist. She can now add novelist to her bio. And Hala Alia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, to join the conversation, here's the email address. You can send us an email. You can also radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. I know Salt Houses was not the original title of your book, but I'm interested in what that title means to you.
So the original title was one that I was very attached to because it had been the working title for all the years that I was working on the book. And then my agent said we needed something that was a little bit more relevant.
What was the original title? Go ahead.
The Carnival Sky.
The Carnival Sky. Okay.
It's pretty. It has nothing to do with the book, but pretty. Right? And so what I did actually was I pulled one of those word cloud things to see which words came up the most frequently. And one of them, not shockingly, was houses. And I kind of put together, there's a scene towards the end where one of the patriarchs, who's now an old man, is looking back at all the different apartments and villas and houses and cities they've lived in and thinks of them as structures of salt that can dissolve in the waves. And so I was like, that's it.
Well, and I was thinking about that as well. In many ways, I mean, salt is kind of bitter to taste by itself,
yeah.
But you add it to something else and it brings out ingredients.
Flavor.
And it is like sand. I mean, it is not a salt house would not survive.
It would not. No. It's in essence something that's transient.
Tell us about the Yaqub family. How do you see them?
I see them as this sort of wacky, uprooted family that is trying to look for belonging in all the wrong places. I think it's in some ways not an uncommon story of displacement and diasporic experience, particularly intergenerational conflict. So you watch these, you know, older generations that had been raised with certain customs and values and perhaps more conservative places, trying to raise children with those same values that are oftentimes incongruent with the new place that they're living in.
Well, and it's interesting in that this is a family, they have money. And obviously,
exactly.
If you are either forced out of your home, your community, if you don't have money, chances are you're going to end up in a refugee camp. They end up in apartments and houses.
Exactly. And that's one of the most important things. I'm glad you brought that up because that's one of the most important things to point out is that this book in no way purports to capture the Palestinian experience as a whole, right? This is a very particular story of a slice of diaspora, of a family that had the means to leave. Most people don't. Mm. You know, and so this is kind of the best of all cases in terms of being able to scrounge together passports and money and education. And even with that, the intergenerational trauma is so salient.
And trauma, I mean, you're a psychologist.
I am.
Trauma means something really powerful and deep.
Absolutely. I think especially in displacement, I think we don't talk about it as much that, you know, a family several generations ago could experience something extremely traumatic like being uprooted, or there's been research done on Holocaust survivors, trauma there, that it ends up trickling down and manifesting in completely different ways in younger generations.
This is always the inevitable question a novelist mm-hmm. is asked, but I know there's probably something about your family that's embedded in this story in terms of being uprooted.
Absolutely.
and kind of far-flung. In
yeah.
terms of what happens to generations.
Totally, yeah. So my parents met and married in Kuwait, and my mother kind of had the foresight to...
They're Palestinian?
They're Palestinian, Syrian. My mom has a Lebanese passport, so they're kind of a mismatch of things. But in that part of the world, you get what your father has in terms of papers or passports. My father had Palestinian, like, laissez-passer, travel documents at the time. So my mother actually gave birth to me in the States. And I got the American passport. We returned to Kuwait, and then when Saddam invaded, they applied for asylum in the United States.
And that was the first, I mean, this was back in the 1980s.
This is, yeah, so 1990 was the invasion. And then, yeah, so we were in Syria for a little bit because my father kind of got stuck in Kuwait. And then by the time he met up with us, we went to Norman, Oklahoma. And this is, I'm always fascinated with where immigrant communities end up. It's always because one person went for education or to open a restaurant or something random. So my uncle-in-law happened to be studying in Norman. And so we went and lived in the Midwest.
So what is home to you? I mean, how do you think about home?
I've reconceptualized it a lot. I think for a long time I was very attached to the idea of finding a place that could carry all of the things that I wanted in my life, and the idea of belonging, and then the idea of being attached to a place. I've sort of let that go, and I think of family more as home now. And by family, I mean both what you're born into and what you choose, so like your tribe. And I think that your tribe migrates, and in that your family migrates, and in that your home migrates too.
So kind of turtle-like in a way. I mean, you have to, you end up having to carry all that.
You take it with you. You take it with you. I mean, I have so much of Beirut in me. I have so much of Palestine in me. I have so much of Oklahoma in me. I don't want to admit that. I have so much of New York. Well, because it's been so long, but I still, you know, I mean, I have so many of these different places that I've lived in, these different houses, these different closets that I've had to empty out. Like, that doesn't go anywhere. And it's taken me a long time to realize I'm owning all of it wherever I am.
Well, it's so interesting / curious because in many ways you have nothing and everything all at the same time.
Absolutely. I feel very rich in a lot of ways in terms of experience, in terms of the places that I've gotten to see. I have a very hard time saying goodbye to even like terrible apartments that I don't like living in.
You get attached?
I have a ritual the night before I move from anywhere where I actually like say goodbye to the walls. Like,
how do you
touch
do that?
Them, I put my cheek against them, and I whisper thank you to, like, I've done this to every house that I've lived in, every apartment that I've lived in. It's my little way of, it's like a little ritual of like saying goodbye and saying thank you. And I've gotten very used to this idea that places are as transient as people.
When did you start doing that? Saying goodbye and thanking.
That's a great question. The first time I remember doing it, I was 12, and we were leaving our house in Maine. We lived in a city called Hamden, Maine, about an hour from Bangor, for just a year. And we were leaving there to go to the Emirates, which is like radically different.
From the Maine to the Emirates.
No.
Wow.
So I remember having that. I remember the walls. My parents had painted them this like mustard yellow. And realizing that someone was going to come and paint them something else was very, very, like, it was very sad to me. And so I waited until everyone fell asleep, and I tiptoed out, and I just, like, laid my cheek against the wall, and I thanked the house, and I said goodbye. And I've been doing that ever since.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your new book.
Sure.
Your debut novel.
So the section is from the perspective of Selma, who's the matriarch, and it takes place in Nablus, in what is now the West Bank, in March 1963. When Selma peers into her daughter's coffee cup, she knows instantly she must lie. Alia has left a smudge of coral lipstick on the rim. The cup is ivory, intricate spirals painted on the exterior in blue, a thin crack snaking down one side. The cup belongs to a newer set, bought here in Nablus when Selma and her husband Hussam arrived nearly 15 years ago. It was the first thing they'd bought, walking through the marketplace in an unfamiliar city. In a stall draped with camel hair coats and rugs, Selma spotted the coffee set, 12 cups stacked next to an ibri with a slender spout. They rested upon a silver tray. It was the tray that gave Selma pause, the triangular pattern so similar to the one her own mother gave her when she first wed. But it was gone, the old tray and coffee set, along with so many of their belongings, the dresses, walnut furniture, Hussam's books, all left behind in that villa, painted the color of peach flesh that had been their home. Selma cried out when she saw the tray, pointed it out to the vendor. He refused to sell it without the coffee set, and so she'd taken it all, walking home with a large newspaper-swathed bundle. It was her first satisfaction in Nablus.
And that's our guest, Hala Alyan, reading from her novel, her debut novel. It is called Salt Houses. It's a lovely section, and it raises so many issues about if you're forced to leave, what do you take?
Yeah.
You know, it's like the house on fire. What do you grab?
Totally.
But for a lot of people who are refugees, oftentimes you have to leave quickly. This family certainly did.
Yeah.
And what do you take? What's the thing that has value or meaning or maybe is just portable and that's why you take it?
I think a lot of times, it's portable. It's where can you put it? Do you have space to put it? I had the briefest of experience with that. I mean, I guess I was there during Kuwait, but I was 4 and I was certainly not making any decisions. My mother and my father poor superheroes. I don't know how they went through that. But I was in Beirut in July 2006 during the war. And I was living in Beirut, going to university there. And there was talk that we were going to evacuate. My mom was in town for the summer. And so she drove me down to my apartment. And at the time, I mean, I guess this is true for any political crisis, even from the perspective of privilege, which is one that I definitely had. Our apartment was like far away from any bombing. We all had American passports. We could leave if we needed to. But I think even just the taste of that, of not knowing if it was going to end, not knowing if I was going to see this place again, not knowing what I was going to take. And my mother parked under the building and was like, "You have 5 minutes. Get everything you want."
5 minutes.
And I froze. I stood in the middle of this apartment. I'd been living freshman and sophomore year of college there and just was like, do I take the sneakers that I like wrote on, all these Nirvana lyrics? Do I take this poster? Do I take these clothes? Do I take this? Do I take this thing my boyfriend gave me? Do I take? I couldn't make a decision. And I think in the end, I like randomly haphazardly grabbed photographs off the wall and that was it. Uh-huh. And then, like, the entire ride back, I was just kicking myself because I was like, I could have taken this, I could have taken that. And that is nothing. I mean, I was able to go, the war obviously was like less than a month, and I was able to go back and get all my stuff. But it was just the tiniest insight into what people go through every single day without the luxury of getting to go back.
And also thinking about how objects become even more meaningful if they're
totally
left behind. Kind of nostalgia when you can't go back to a place. I'm thinking all those people in Syria that just, mm-hmm. they cannot go back to Aleppo because it doesn't really exist.
Right.
And so that becomes so important in a person's life.
Absolutely. And I think there are certain things that we take for granted, like, you know, heirlooms, you know, family objects that you get to pass along, like your grandmother's portrait that she did when she was 16, your great-grandmother's wedding dress, you know, like things like that, that you, for a lot of people, those things don't exist. You don't have access to them anymore. And so you have to kind of recreate memory and sort of try to create it for future generations without those original objects.
I mean, it's interesting to think about this family as, I mean, in many ways, you know, children leave home.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that, you
totally.
Know, the home still stays, the family is there, but nonetheless, children often leave home
totally.
And often should leave home mm-hmm. and try to figure out life for themselves. But under these circumstances, you're forced out and you can't come back.
Yeah. And
it's a different
experience. It's a completely different experience. I mean, I think not having the luxury to return to a place, not being able to say, like, you know, I'm going to go revisit my old town. And look how everything is smaller than I remember, because I used to be smaller the last time I was here and things seemed bigger. Like, you know, to not have the opportunity to go sleep in a bed that you've slept in since you were 5 or 6, for those things to be simply vanished. Mm-hmm. And that's what is happening for millions of people around the world. The things that they grew up with, the homes, the loves, the places, they're gone.
Talk about heirlooms. I'm thinking about the stories that families hand down mm-hmm. for this family, maybe even for your family. Are those stories the kind of heirlooms?
They become the heirlooms, absolutely. I mean, that becomes the home in a lot of ways. The memory, I mean, when you don't have an object or a place to affix meaning onto, right? If there's not a story, you're going to find one to tell, right?
Right.
And I think when you don't have those things to place meaning onto, you'll place it on whatever you can. And so that will take the form of kinship. It will take the form of family mythology. It will take the form of storytelling, of music, of art. And I think that's in that way, you know, we find ways to sort of create and recreate memory.
Did your parents kind of protect you from some of this stuff? Is it even possible to do that when you're so
yeah.
much on the move?
I don't know that. I mean, I think they did an incredible job with what they had. My parents came to this country. I mean, it's an old story, right? Like they came to this country with nothing and they right now they both have doctorates and they have American passports and they have like really done, you know, knock wood, an amazing job for themselves. I think they did the best they could with two very small. My mother was pregnant with my brother,
wow.
and I was 4 when we were fleeing. When we were fleeing Kuwait,
right?
Yeah,
right.
So I think they did, you know, the best they could. I think for me as a child, I was, you know, suddenly in the Midwest, having to learn English, having to acclimate to this new place, and I do think that's like the beginning of becoming a writer, and it's the beginning of becoming a psychologist, because you like have to observe, you have to pay attention, you can't let little details slip by because you have to learn to acclimate. And I think that we all had to do that to certain extents in different ways. Obviously, adults have to do it very differently than children.
I mean, it's interesting to think of storytelling and therapy, and I think they are similar in many ways. And as a therapist, you hear the stories that people tell about themselves, whether they're true or not. It has meaning and value to
I mean, I've my life's work, my currency is storytelling. I'm either bearing witness to it with patients, or I'm trying to create it myself as a writer. I think in terms of narrative.
Do you? Yeah, totally.
I mean, I dream in terms of narrative. Like, I try to take the, when I'm working with a patient or with a client, like taking what seems like disjointed pieces of symptoms and patterns and trying to put it together to make a coherent whole. I think that that work of trying to create order out of something chaotic is, you know, that's sort of what I've spent my life trying to do anyway. And so it makes sense that I just fell into these careers.
We posted something on Facebook. You did a TEDx a couple of years ago. I think you were still in graduate school.
It was a few years ago, yeah.
But you talked about, and I can relate to this entirely, about listening in on other people's conversations.
Yes.
Going to an airport or a train station.
Absolutely.
And just being mesmerized
by
the things that people say or what's going on around you.
I'm incurably curious. I'm like so curious. I'm so nosy. I always want to know what's going on. And if I don't, then I'll create a story there. I love walking in neighborhoods and peeking in people. Now I just sound like a stalker.
peeking
in people's like windows and just being like, what's the life that's going on there? What are the things that are going on there? And I think that's a comment. I mean, I think like a lot of people who are drawn to storytelling and art think that way, right? You need that curiosity, that spark of curiosity to create.
I hate it when people have curtains.
I know. Like, why are you denying me?
The right to look in your window. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation.
Sure.
Talking with Hala Alyan. She is a poet. She's a psychologist, and now she's a novelist. Her new novel, her first novel, has just been published. It's called Salt Houses, about the displacement of a Palestinian family, a family called the Yaqubs, and what happens to the generations of Yaqubs as they scatter to different continents and to different countries, raising all sorts of questions about identity, faith, belonging, storytelling. And I do want to talk with our guest about emotional code switching. You can join our conversation. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, our guest is poet and psychologist Hala Alyan. Her debut novel, Salt Houses, explores issues of identity and dislocation. It's about several generations of a Palestinian family whose uprooting sends them to far-flung regions of the world, including the United States. This is also the story of Alyan's family. She was born in the U.S. She's lived in places in Kuwait, Tripoli, Amman, Abu Dhabi, I'm sure many, many more as well. She's speaking tonight at 7 at One Book Bookstore, which is in Elkins Park. I mentioned emotional code switching. One of your characters talks about that. What is that?
I took it from code switching is usually referred to linguistic code switching. So people that are bilingual, for example, English and Arabic, having that conversation where you seamlessly throw in Arabic words and English words and you're kind of going back and forth. That character was sort of talking more about an emotional, kind of a cultural emotional code switching where you can kind of go back and forth between different emotions that are more appropriate depending on the place that you're in, which I do think is one of, you know, you do have to have a certain, you have to develop a certain chameleon-like capacity in diaspora and immigration and displacement because that's survival, is you have to be able to fit in to a certain extent to the place that you've arrived to.
So you might be a slightly different person depending on
where you are
and who you're with.
100%, yeah. That intersection of space and identity and self is one that I've always really been interested in. I'm definitely a different person when I'm in Beirut versus when I'm in the Emirates versus when I'm in the Midwest versus when I'm in New York.
Or on the radio.
Or when, right now. A completely different person right now. And part of that is like it's adaptive. Right, there's a survival mechanism there that you, even as a young child, like to fit into a certain place, you have to be able to again, observe it, make sense of it, put it together, and then mimic it to a certain extent.
I mean, it is a kind of multiple selves that I think we all have. I mean, maybe not to the degree that you're talking about, but I think a lot of us...
You need it to a certain extent no matter what.
Figure out sort of how to adapt. Oh, absolutely. I can say this in under these circumstances, but perhaps not that.
Absolutely. And I think for certain communities, I mean, I think for communities where, you know, certain bodies, like black bodies, veiled bodies, but, you know, certain bodies are read as different right away, right? I'm ethnically ambiguous, right? So you can look at me and it's sort of like, not really sure how this particular body is going to be read. But I think some people don't have that luxury. And so I think in that case, that sort of emotional code switching becomes even more a matter of survival.
There's each chapter has is about a different part of the family. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about Mustafa.
Mm-hmm.
So
Mustafa was actually the original, I mean, I had started this, it was originally a short story about Mustafa. And I was just very interested in this, like, young, restless, frustrated male living in that post-48, pre-67 period, very politically tense, not knowing what his place was, not knowing what was going to happen with his homeland, turning to things like friends and mosque and, you know, sort of a half-hearted faith that kind of came. It was a fickle faith, right? It comes and goes. Looking for community, right. Looking for a tribe.
Which he finds in this mosque.
Which he finds in this mosque. And then I think when I was writing that short story, that's actually when I realized that I was just so captivated by his sister and his mother. And I was just kind of, I followed that curiosity backwards and forwards, and I wanted to see what would happen to them. And I also, obviously, as someone who's partial to houses, I realized that they were going to lose their house in a few years, because the Six-Day War was coming, but they didn't know that yet. And so at that point, I felt like I was emotionally hooked and I had to tell the story.
You have written short stories, you've written poems. Did you have to kind of trick yourself then to write
100%,
a novel?
100%, yeah.
Like, don't say it's a 250-page novel.
Yeah, never said it was a novel until I was looking for agents. I referred vaguely to a longer project that I was working on.
You couldn't even say the word to yourself?
No, especially to myself. Yeah, I think partly I'm superstitious and partly it's an enormous weight. Like, and once you've put it out there, then you're either a failed novelist or you're bound to write a novel. And I always like to know that I can change my mind.
Oh, do you? Oh,
yeah, that's so important to me. I always need to know that I can, like, not do the thing. And so it was always, you know, this longer project until it was like 500 pages. I was like, now I have to just call it what it is and start sending it out to people. I had to trick. I mean, I think it helped that I was able to turn it into the thing I wasn't supposed to be doing, because I started it while I was finishing up my dissertation and I needed to be doing that. Right. And so this got to be the kind of delightful extra thing that I
was
working on.
The rebellious thing?
Right. This was the thing I wasn't supposed to be working on, which is always guarantees I will work on it.
You're a contrarian.
I'm very much a contrarian, yeah.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book, and it probably requires a little bit of a setup here, just so we know who this is and where she is.
So Saad, at this point, is she's the great-grandchild of the original matriarch. She grew up in Kuwait, and then when she was 18, after Saddam's invasion, found herself randomly in Paris that summer and decided to get married to a man in Paris, to a Lebanese man in Paris, to avoid having to just go back to her family. And this is her, you know, a couple of decades later, she's had two children, she's been in Boston for a long time, and she's returning to Beirut. And she's talking about why. Saad's hope is that somehow Beirut will fix whatever hungry, invisible malaise she felt in Boston after Ali left. At first, she thought it was just that she was aging, at the end of her 20s, entering her 30s. But no, it was something larger. An epiphany at a gas station one February evening as she stood holding the gas pump, breathing in that addictive scent, and suddenly she understood that this place was the malaise. It was in the sprawling malls, the highway lights, the tax season, suburban America itself, in whose veins she lived and slept and woke for years. Beirut called to her. She wanted somewhere new. She wanted to go home. She told her children Zain and Manad, though Manad just stared at her and said flatly, "What home?" And she wanted to say home as in somewhere familiar, somewhere people look like us, talk like us, where you guys can learn Arabic and be near your grandparents and never come home asking what raghead means.
Mm. Can you relate to that?
Definitely, yeah.
Sort of feeling like the other.
Absolutely.
Even in, you live in New York, right, or Brooklyn?
Even in
or?
New York, I think you're other. I mean, I think, yeah, I felt other even in Beirut, I mean, to a certain extent. I think that's one of the things about belonging to a diasporic community is you sort of pretty young have to get used to the idea that you're going to be different, mm-hmm. you know. And you can embrace that. You can try to resist it. I tried to resist it for a very, very long time. I think the end result is always the same, which is that you just kind of come to terms with it.
She describes, and I remember she's in the U.S. during 9/11,
mm-hmm.
so she sees the towers going down.
Yes,
and
she does.
You describe her sort of feeling the need to apologize.
Yeah.
But also, and I have to say, I totally identified with this, and it's so macabre, but this, she's looking at those people that jumped off
mm-hmm.
or for whatever reason
yeah.
Jumped off of the top of the World Trade
yeah.
Center, trying to imagine what they were thinking, what they were feeling,
right.
why did
right.
they do what they did, what did they think was going to happen.
Right.
And I remember there were several pictures in the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
and I just couldn't take my eyes off one of those pictures because I trying to imagine if I were that person.
Would you have jumped? Yeah.
What two mm-hmm. awful, awful choices, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very captivating. I watched the footage a lot when I was writing that section. And it was the equal parts kind of not being able to look away and wanting so badly to like turn the computer off and like not look at it anymore. But I felt like it was sort of important to keep looking. And again, it's sort of bearing witness, right? And to be unflinching in the face of these sort of conflicts and wars mm. and attacks, regardless of what soil they're taking, you know, they're taking place on. And I think in the case of 9/11, there was something, you know, it was hard to look away because it was so absolutely destructive and devastating and awful. And people were put in this position of having, right, like you said, you know, you die in the building or you jump.
Yeah. I mean, two just the most horrific kind of choices.
They're like terrible choices, of course. Yeah.
And how does someone decide under yeah. those circumstances? Maybe you just don't.
I don't know. Yeah. Whatever. I mean, I hope we will never know. But yeah, I mean, I imagine that there is a certain something kicks in and it's the you have to just decide between what two you'd rather. Yeah.
I'm curious to just because, I mean, you were born in the U.S., you've lived all over mm-hmm. many parts of the world, largely in the Middle East, about what it's like to live in the United States now. Is it different?
Mm. I think so. I think it's different in that I'm less apologetic about my identity. I feel more confident in my history and my background and my understanding of myself and my understanding of, you know, where my people came from and how I ended up being here. I think growing up, you know, I asked to be called Holly for a long
time.
Did
you really?
I did,
oh,
yeah.
That's so interesting.
I think we all sort of anglicized our names. I mean, again, I live in Brooklyn, right? So that's different than, you know, some of the places I was living in the Midwest. But I wanted to fit in so badly. And I think I have a very different understanding of what it is to fit in and what it is to have an identity and how to be proud of that identity, how to be proud of the fact that I'm Arab and that I'm an American and that I can be both. And it's like a dialectical truth. It's not either or, it's both and. And to be more confident having conversations about that identity with people.
Mm. Feeling just more confident because of yourself? Because obviously there's a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric.
Sure, sure.
I mean, certainly coming yeah. from the White House and other parts
Absolutely.
Of the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of it, too, is just, like, knowledge. I mean, I think when you're, like, 9, 10, 11, you don't really know. I mean, you know, you're taught certain things. Again, textbooks in the United States focus on certain narratives. And that's true, I think, for most countries, right? And the narratives that I was exposed to oftentimes did not include the Arab narrative or they did in a way that was very politicized or exotified. So I think being able to have gone back to the Middle East and coming back with a different understanding of my history has helped me just feel more at ease with it.
Do you feel this book, some of the reviewers have said it sort of challenges this stereotype about, if not refugees, mm-hmm. but certainly about people from the Middle East. Was that part of your intention?
You know, I don't know that it was. I think there's always something dangerous about setting out with an agenda, right? Trying to write or create art with an agenda. I think, you know, that happened very organically. I knew that I wanted to do justice to this family. I knew that I wanted to do justice to the stories that I'd grown up hearing both in my family and in the families of people that I loved. And I think that I couldn't help but create a family that was, you know, three-dimensional and had different, you know, motivations and desires and incentives. And I think that does run contrary to a lot of the mainstream narratives that we hear about Arabs and Palestinians in this country.
Has your family read this?
My brother has.
And what does your brother say?
He loved it. My husband has. He loved it. Most of my family lives in the Middle East still, so they haven't received it yet. And my father and mother very much wanted the actual book.
Like
the advanced
online
copies. So I'm excited to hear what they have to say about it.
Yeah. And did your brother say, "Oh, I see bits and pieces of me in your book"?
Yeah,
I mean, it was almost inevitable, I would think.
He like stayed up all night and read it and then sent me this pretty beautiful text saying, "You did it. You wrote the story. You did it. You did it." He just kind of kept saying, "You did it." And it was such a it was a very heartwarming moment.
And being a poet, which I always think, you know, poets not have to, but they do choose their words so carefully. I mean, poetry is about just the sort of conciseness of language. Mm-hmm. Was that a help in writing a novel, or did you feel like you had to overcome some of that?
For me, it was the opposite. I had one of my first readers was like, take out half the adjectives and adverbs and then take out another.
Really?
So I think I am programmed to towards this more flowery, romantic kind of language. So I had to work on making it a little bit sparser. I do think that once I didn't have to think about a piece as being short, like in terms of a poem, I kind of was like, went all out, and then had to go back and edit a lot. The most amount of work was editing.
Really? Painful? Painful?
Excruciating. Yeah. I mean, but also, to be fair, though, it's how I wrote it. So I didn't write it chronologically. I had, a folder in my laptop that was called The Carnival Sky. And then you went inside and there were like hundreds of like scene between Suad and Ali, like scene in Kuwait, 1970. So I had to go back and stitch it all together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I did not write it in a very smart way. And I've learned from that for future projects. But I would say the editing was definitely like a beast.
And why did you want to be a psychologist? As you said, you're curious.
I'm curious. I wanted to help people. I think I really believe in the power of language and in the power of examination and the power of exploring oneself and kind of unpacking what it is that we've been born with and given and what it is that we've acquired along the way and seeing if there's a way to live an authentic life because of it or in spite of it, depending on the circumstance. To be completely honest, I think I was first drawn to it because I started, I did all of it through kindergarten. So I started grad school, I was like 22. So I do think, but to be completely honest, part of it was like I wanted to understand myself.
Yes. And I think that's true for most people.
I think so too, yeah.
In the mental health profession.
And I think as the years went on and that sort of started to become a little bit clearer and the writing definitely helped, it was like, oh, I feel like I have a skill set that I can bring to other people and I'm a fan in particular of narrative therapy when it comes to working with immigrants and working with people who've, sort of survived atrocities and kind of.
Is that the kind of people you work with or you are attracted to work with?
Some of them, yeah. I do a lot of trauma work in general and a lot of work with Arab Americans, a lot of work with Arab immigrants. And I do think there's something really powerful about reclaiming a narrative and rewriting it and sort of looking at it from a different way and finding a way to be authentic within that narrative. So I think that's a lot of the work that I do.
Well, Hala Alyan, thank you so much for joining us today
on
Radio
you.
Times. Congratulations on your book as
thank
well.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is called, it's her debut novel, and it's called Salt Houses. And Hala Alyan will be at Open Book Bookstore. That's in Elkins Park tonight at 7 o'clock. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. To find out much more about the program, you can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.